Devach. So the truth is, I came in here still not 100% sure what we would talk about. We go in order, move around. I think that right now we'll start with the approach of moving around. We'll see how we'll progress. What I want to do now is talk about, we're calling it subjects in Tanakh. A little bit about the beginning of Shoftim. It's some relevant messages that we may find there. So Shoftim opens up after the death of Yeshua ben Nun. I'm sorry, we lost you there. So again, Sefer Shoftim opens with Yeshua's nifter. They have to continue the conquest. And now they don't have that one leader. So the question is, what's supposed to happen now? Now, we won't get now into why, but Lamai said there was going to be a change in the way it was going to work. Up till now, Yeshua was leading the nation as one unified unit, conquering. And now it was going to have to work a little differently. Each Shevet was going to have to take on the conquest of their area. So now everybody understood this, but the immediate question was, who should be the Shevet to take on the next stage of the battle? This was a very important question. Why was this such an important question? Because at this point, Yeshua was Nifter. Yeshua was the great leader who led them from one victory to the next. Now the Canaanim are waiting to see, what's going to happen now? Maybe now we can beat them. They lost their leader. And the first fight, the first next battle would be very decisive in the moral, in the sense of the morale. In the sense, would it give the Canaanim a great boost and the confidence to come fight even harder? A loss would also be a blow to the morale of the Bnei Yisrael. And therefore, it was important to make sure that this next battle, that it should be very clear, Bnei Yisrael and to the Canaanim, that nothing has changed, that the victories are going to continue to be victories. And therefore, it was an important question they needed to consult to find out from the Dvar Hashem. Who should be the next Shevet to go continue the process? So what happens? So Shoftim begins by saying, "Vayi achrei Moshe Yeshua," when Yeshua was nifter. So, "Vayishalu bnei Yisrael b'Hashem leimor." So the bnei Yisrael consulted Hashem, asking, "Who should now go on to take the next fight, the next battle against the Canaanim?" And as we discussed, this was simply understood, this was the significance, the critical nature of this question. And Hashem's answer is, Vayomer Hashem, Yehuda Yale. It should be Yehuda. Okay, why Yehuda? So we'll see momentarily. We'll see momentarily. Well, let's just note one thing here. Vayomer Yehuda says, "B'shimen Ochiv, alei iti begayrali. Do you want to join me?" The Yehuda is going to be the ones making the next campaign. But he says to Shimon, "Do you want to join me? Should we throw in our lots together? You'll help me with my campaign, and I'll help you with yours." So some of the Mefarshim say that there was a lot of significance to this. Shimon was actually the weakest and the less successful Shevet among the Shvatim. And therefore, what was actually happening here was that Yehuda, as in order to enhance their own merits when they're going to take on the next fight, are doing it in such a way. We're going to make a partnership with somebody who needs it. We're going to form a real chesed reality, and that's an investment that we're making into our efforts. Now, What happens afterwards? What happens afterwards is, sorry. Okay, they have a they have an they the first place they go to is a place called Bezek. They smite the place, and we're not going to get into all the details here. They capture the king, a place called Bezek. Apparently, Bezek is old. A place called Bezek. They capture the king. Okay, a little incident there. We're not going to get into that now. It really deserves its own study. But it says, then you go on for the rest of the pasuk, the rest of the perek, it starts getting monotonous. If you read through the first perek of Shoftim, it almost seems like, okay. One of those prakim, it's like, okay, we get the idea. What does it sound like? It sounds like this. Okay, they have to fight Bezek first. Then they fight Yerushalayim, they capture it, they smite it by sword, they burnt the city down. Then they go down to fight the Kanani in the hard Negev Shvela. And then they went to the Kanani in Chevron. And they smite Shesha Achim and Eltam. Then they go from there to Debir. Okay, another little incident, which you're going to skip now. Kalev, he personally captures it. Fine. Again, we're moving further. Then they smite the people of Tzfat. They smite the people of Aza. Right, of Ashkelon, of Ekron, one after the next. It was one area where they had a hard time conquering. But fine. What we see here is this monotonous. They went to this place and smote it, this place and smote it, this place and smote it, this place and smote it. It might sound monotonous until you get to the next part. Let me move on to the next Shvat. What happens after that? Okay, next is Binyamin. Binyamin did not drive out the Yevusim who were settled in Yerushalayim. The two parts of Yerushalayim, right? There was the Yerushalayim that was part of Yehuda's part, there was Yerushalayim that was part of Binyamin's part. So there remained a pocket of Yevusi in Yerushalayim amongst the Bnei Binyamin. Okay. Then we have an incident with Beis Yosef, with Yosef, Shevet Yosef. Again, I'm not getting into the incidents here, but what happens here? So you have Menashe. They did their campaign, but they did not drive out the people of Beis Sha'an, Tanach, Yishveh Dor, a few different places, and they remained with pockets of Canaan there also. Then the pasuk continues and says, even though Yisrael was powerful, they subjugated the Canaan there, and they became tributaries. But they didn't drive them out. Ephraim didn't drive the Canaanim out of Gezer. Okay, they remained there a pocket. Zvulun didn't drive the people out of Kitron. A few other places, they had their pockets.
Were they supposed to drive them out?
Oh, this is what I'm getting at. First thing I want to note is the contrast. Okay, when we read through Yehuda, we see they went this place and smote it, smote, 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 basically cleared out the whole area. Except this one area where it was stuck, they just couldn't do it. But it was one place to the next. You move on to the other Shvatim, and the whole tone changes. They all went about their campaigns, but they remained a pocket here, a pocket there. They didn't really get to wiping everybody out. What was supposed to be happening? But the first thing is, we see the contrast, and this also perhaps gives us an indication of why Yehuda was chosen to do the job in the first place. Look at the difference in what it looks like, basically, all the other Shvatim. So what was happening here? So you continue through the end of the perek. You continue through the end of the perek, and it's basically after Yehuda is one shevet after the next, not quite wiping everybody out, not quite driving everybody out. What was the reality of it? So let's understand. The Bnei Yisrael were meant to purify their territory, drive everybody out. It didn't exactly happen. Why didn't it happen? For a very practical, realistic reason. Warfare is very hard. Yehuda are going from one battle to the next without taking breaks. Very, very intense. They finished a battle, pushing on to the next one. What do we mean by not taking a break? I don't know exactly what it meant. I'm sure they rested maybe for a day, maybe 2, 3 days. I don't know exactly. But whatever the case is, the other Shvatim gave themselves a little bit more slack. There's no question that they all intended to do it. There's no question that they all intended to do it. But the difference was that, okay, we just had a long battle. It's okay if we take a break for a couple of months. And again, I don't know the timelines, but this is the idea. Might take some time until we can get on to the next battle. Whereas with Yehuda, they were pushing themselves relentlessly. Pushing themselves relentlessly. I'm sure they took a breath, but then it was on, the next campaign, the next campaign, the next campaign, one after the next, just not stopping. And the other Shvatim took it slower. Again, did they sign? This is it, we're done? Presumably not. But they gave themselves more time, they gave themselves more slack. So what happens next? What happens next is, I'll say it in simple contemporary terms, and then we'll actually see how the pasuk lays it down. But what happened was that the Bnei Yisrael didn't realize that there was actually a bell that was going to ring. That Hashem had allocated a certain amount of time for them to get the job done. Right? He was giving them the divine assistance, the siyata dishmaya. But he was waiting to see, are you going to be doing the job energetically, diligently? Of course, there's always the, you have to do it on human terms. But it's always up to the person to try to figure out, am I really doing everything I could be doing in human terms or not? And there was, again, that secret deadline with the bell. And unfortunately, the bell rang while they still consider themselves in the middle of the job. So how does Perek Beis start? So again, Perek Aleph is basically describing how each Shevet left a pocket here, left a pocket there, didn't quite drive these ones out of here and these ones out of there. Perek Beis starts with, Vayal Malach Hashem in Agilgal HaBoichim, Navi came, and he gives the message from Hashem as follows. I told you, I took you out of Mitzrayim. I brought you to Eretz Canaan. I said I'm going to keep my relationship with you forever, the bris. Don't make any pacts with the people of the land. Smash their altars. You didn't listen to me. What do you mean you didn't listen to me? What we mean you didn't listen to me is you didn't go about it with that energy. You didn't go about it with that alacrity of just one after the next. What is this that you've done? Now, you can say, okay, we're going to do it now. Sorry. Gamamati, now I've said, at this point, I'm not going to drive them out before you anymore. They're going to be thorns in your side. And their gods are going to be stumbling blocks for you. So this was the message that the Navi delivered to the Bnei Yisrael. And they all raised their voices and wept. And they called that place, it was a place, a gathering place. This was still a phenomenon that you had in the early days in Eretz Yisrael. It didn't last all the way. You don't see this in the later periods. But before the Malachim in the years of the Shoftim, you see this a number of times. It was mamish, a gathering of the entire people, because the Navi had a message for them, and they took the message. They wept, Vayizbichu Sham LaHashem, and they offered Karbanos to Hashem. In other words, they like, as we say, they took the point taken. Meaning they took it in. They acknowledged their failure. They expressed it through their tshuva, and they're okay. This is what it's going to be now. So let's bring out a few things here in terms of what is the parsha conveying to us. So just in order to note, let's again note the nature of the people of those days. It would be very hard for us to look back at them and say, huh, see that? Yehuda pushed themselves beyond what we would consider realistic in human terms. This boom and then boom, boom, boom. And the other ones, again, it was each shevet according to It's nature, but giving themselves the time, giving themselves. Now, there's no question that human beings have to operate that way. We have to sleep every night, even if there's a lot of important things going on. There's no question we have to operate that way. But it's a fine line between just sitting back, between giving yourself the necessary breaks and just giving yourself a little too much relaxation. But whatever the case is, we're not talking about people who decided that they're dropping the case. So let's just first, as a tribute to that great generation, note the response to the Navi. Look how different this looked from the later generations toward the Churban. The Navi came with a harsh message. In the later generations, he got a lot of resentment and opposition. Here, it was seeing again, this was the nature, this was the atmosphere, this was the reality of Klal Yisrael. A Navi came with a hard message. A harsh message, everybody lowered their heads. And there was a national weeping. It's an amazing thing. We have to note that the greatness of the people then. It was a national regret, national weeping. They accepted, offered karbanas. They recognized the failure, integrated it. Now they're going to have to live with the consequences, which we're going to discuss momentarily. But this, we should note this as a tribute to their greatness. So, a couple of other points, what we should be taking away from this little incident, this sequence, not little incident, we're talking about a year-long nationwide story, is also the relevance of this in our own lives. We all know that at the end of the day, there's a bell. We don't know when it's going to ring. And we know that we are here to accomplish. We're here to accomplish. And the realization that we're meant to be on the job. Now, again, I don't want to give the wrong message. I don't want to give the wrong message in either direction. When we talk about accomplishing, when we talk about conquests, we all have our conquests that we need to be busy with. Our conquest in terms of our own character, our conquests in terms of our relationship with Hashem. I have to realize when we talk about conquering a city, say, if you can conquer an area of struggle, let's say there's a relationship in your life that requires conquering. Someone in the family challenges you. Someone in the neighborhood, someone in the workplace, whatever it is, it's just one example. These are areas of conquest. We're meant to be using such situations to be bettering ourselves. We're bettering ourselves to be using these situations to grow. And this is what we have to be busy with. Utilizing the opportunities for growth in our lives, utilizing the opportunities to get closer to Hashem. And Hashem says, I gave you a neshama. What I want back from you after the time comes is a neshama that's shining brilliantly. So to speak, Hashem gives each of us, we call it. No, it's not, I mean, we all know the term Tzelem Elokim. We all know the term Tzelem Elokim. But we have a Sfarna that tells us, and this is a point that's developed in many of the Sfarim, before you get too proud of having a Tzelem Elokim, you have to appreciate what it means. Sfarna says Tzelem, the word Tzelem means, so to speak, raw material. You were given, kiviyochol, raw godly material, material of amazing. I won't even use the word substance, an amazing entity called an Isha. It was given to you in raw form. And your job is to come back to Hashem when the bell rings and say, look what I made out of it. Look at the brilliant, magnificent Bria that I sculpted it into, that I polished it into. And this is something that we want to be conscious of as we move through life, that this is what we're here for. This is what we're here for. We're here to achieve that, to accomplish that. How do we do this? Like we said before, through the relationships, through the circumstances, whatever's going on in our life, to be utilizing the situations for growth and getting closer to Hashem. And not to be caught by surprise by the bell and say, hey, wait, I have a bunch of projects that I need to start. I haven't started yet. So this is where we're being shown that on a certain national level. That you have to do things on human terms. There's no question about it. But yet, realize that there's a lot to be done. Keep at it. Keep at it. Give yourself the space you need. But don't overdo it excessively.
Just yesterday, I was in the Pekelos about that Hashem gave him, made us the ceremony, king, people, you say, oh, yeah, that we are made instead of kings. I want to know what exactly, how would you explain ceremony? Is
What is the Tzelem
it in the Shona? What is it?
Elokim? So what is the Tzelem Elokim? That's a big question that goes way beyond me. But we all are a Tzelem Elokim. So let's try to appreciate it. So we have to understand. So we have to understand that there are different layers of the Tzelem Elokim. There are different layers of Tzelem Elokim. There's the Tzelem Elokim that is common to all humans. And you see that in that Mishnah also, right? Chaviv Adam So you see that there's the layer of Adam that has the Tzelem Elokim, and then there's the layer of Yisrael that are actually considered Hashem's mishpacha, so to speak. It goes up and up and up. But we see in the Sfarim that there are different layers of it and different levels of depth. The Tzelem Elokim that's common to all humans is what we would call the nefesh. I'm sorry. The seichel, the ability to live beyond just the here and now. No animals make long-term plans. No animals think beyond instinct. If you see animals that do set up for the long term, it's instinct. It's not that they're actually weighing, is it better for me to put in here? And then they're not making these types of cheshbonos. They respond to instinct. They respond to the here and now. The nefesh of man, the different level of man, is reflected in the fact that he's able to think beyond himself, beyond the here and now, and to invest in the future, which is really meant to be investing in the ultimate future, the real future, with the life that really starts. Right now is just it's a short little preparation period. It's like the caterpillar in the cocoon. These, as a Hashem, which have all of us at least 150 years, but it's a brief preparation period. So on the basic level, that's the Tzelem Elokim. Tzelem Elokim is that seichel, the ability to see further beyond and invest in that. The next layer of Tzelem Elokim is the Tzelem Elokim that's reflected in the neshama, which does is exclusive to the Bnei Yisrael, which a goy, the non-Jew, has the infrastructure to connect to. You have to bear that in mind. A cat, as sincere as it might be, can never gain the status of, can never move himself. And the most virtuous cat in the world can't become a Jew. Right? But all the human race does have that ability. And that's a deep discussion, which we're not going to really get into properly now. But that next level is when the person actually gains the higher level of the neshama, which goes all the way up. And that is really the kiviyachol, the divine connection in the person. We have to realize that I've said this a lot of times, we'll say it again, that our bodies are not you. When you look in the mirror, you wonder who's the real you. The real you is pretty much under general anesthesia right now. You aren't experiencing yourself right now. Real you is the neshama. You're plunged into a body for the purpose of that little preparation period. But really, what you're doing is you're setting up for the real life, which starts once the neshama is unleashed, unfettered from the body. The body still retains a place of kavod, which becomes relevant later down the line. But you are investing in your neshama. And anything that's why, when we talk about mitzvahs that we don't understand the reason for. Of course, there have to be mitzvahs you don't understand the reason for, because the mitzvahs are primarily directed at the neshama. And the neshama is way beyond your experience. So, on the contrary, if we would understand all the mitzvahs, it would mean that they're all limited into our bodily experience. But they're not. We're busy dealing with the unknown us. We're busy nourishing and enhancing the unknown us, preparing ourselves for that true existence. And this is that next layer of the Tzelem Elokim. Okay, this is mamish, the tip of the iceberg. But the next point, coming back to this parsha, and that is the following. You see on and on, again and again and again in the Torah, the importance to rid all of the foreign presence from Eretz Yisrael. Again, right, the admonitions are mamish ubiquitous. And as we see here, only Yehuda managed to really do the job. It's not by chance that Yehuda remained in Eretz Yisrael much longer than all the rest of the Shvatim. All the rest of the Shvatim found themselves in Golus much earlier. Why? And here's really the point. Hashem wanted a land that is absolutely sterile, that the only frame of reference are his values. Nothing else exists. There's no exposure to anything else. Anything else is an abstract theoretical thing that you read about that exists in other countries, but you've never actually seen it. The power of exposure and the power of the environment is very great, and people tend to underestimate that. That's just a very famous classic Rambam, that your reality around you is what sets for you standards. Normal, we've spoken about normal a few times. So the definition of normal is what I've grown up with. That's the definition of normal. I mean me, not what you've grown up with, but I've grown up with. That we all understand that anybody who does less than us is not quite up to par. Anybody who does more than us is being a little bit excessive. In other words, it's really the environment around you that establishes for yourself what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. I'll say it even more if we want to go blunt. What is an acceptable way to react if someone makes you really, really upset? What's the range of acceptable reactions? Let me ask this. Is it acceptable to pull out a knife and stab the person? Shouldn't do that, right? It's wrong. It goes against halacha according to all opinions. Would you ever entertain the thought? No. Why? So the initial thought will be because it's wrong, but that's not really the reason. You know, the real reason why you would never entertain the thought is because there is no such thing in your reality. When you know something is wrong, you may have sometimes have to overcome. You never have to overcome the urge. You may want to scream. I don't know what else you might think of doing. There's going to be a range, right? But you'll never entertain the thought. You will entertain the thought of things that you know are wrong, and you'll have to overcome. But there are things you'll never entertain the thought because in your reality, they just didn't happen, even though we all know of places where that is considered a wrong, but it's an understandable reaction. Again, we don't personally know such people. I mean, I hope not. But I don't know. I grew up in Brooklyn. I can tell you the places where it probably is socially acceptable. Again, wrong, but you know, something you may have to overcome.
Is that Rav Dessler's point of choice?
And that very much ties into it. Yeah, that very much ties into it. He doesn't so much, what we're discussing now is one factor of that. He doesn't so much focus on the environment aspect. But my point is that what we consider acceptable and unacceptable is not just a question of what we understand is right and wrong, but it's very much an issue of what were we exposed to. And that's why it's very important when you're deciding where you want to live, who you want to live amongst. You want to put yourself into a place that's going to hold you up to a high standard. This was Hashem's demand of the Bnei Yisrael. I don't want you to be in a place where you know what's right and you have to make sure not to do the wrong thing. I want you to be in a higher place. I want you to be in a place where there's a level of wrong that just doesn't exist. It's just not a part of your reality. You've never seen it. It's not real. It might be abstract and in theory. You've never seen it, and it just isn't there. This is why it was so important to Hashem that the reality in Eretz Yisrael be absolutely sterile, and therefore these nations who are living in ways that were so contrary to Hashem's value system, not that they should be subjugated, they just shouldn't be there. That Eretz Yisrael should be an absolutely sterile environment where all you know is Torah values, Torah standards. This was the advantage from the beginning that Yehuda had over all the rest of the Shvatim. And that is very much what contributed toward the fact that the other Shvatim started dropping significantly earlier than Yehuda did. And even when it did start happening, it was a much faster pace by the other Shvatim than Yehuda. And we see soon enough the terrible story of Pilegesh Begivon. That is also something that we should dedicate a whole shiur to. What happened there? What happened there is exactly what we're discussing. There was the area that had the pockets of Canaanim that still constituted a certain example for the lowest level of Jewish youth. But they saw this going on. They saw certain behaviors going on, and that's why what happened happened. In Yehuda, this couldn't have happened, at least for a while. Why couldn't it happen? Because there was no such thing. It just didn't exist. It just didn't exist. This is part of to be able to appreciate what the reality in those days was by appreciating the sterility that we lived with, that Hashem was wanted for the Bnei Yisrael. How is it relevant to us? The reason this is relevant to us is for us to be able to appreciate what we're contending with. Sometimes we don't even realize that. We live in a world that we are, from all sides, being assaulted by things that completely go against our value system. See, yesterday's parsha. Parsha ends with, "Don't stray after the ideas of the mind or the sights of your eyes." The ideas of the mind mean, it means wrong ideas. Minus, meaning it means wrong hashkafas, apikarsis. And the sights of your eyes means temptation. So the Sfarim tell us that those are one of the six, there are six always relevant mitzvahs, six mitzvahs that are relevant all the time. That's one of the six. Now, what are the others? You have emunah, we understand why that's relevant all the time. Avas Hashem, relevant all the time. Yiras Hashem, relevant all the time. Why is this all the time? Because you're never allowed to stray. But then every loisa say should be all the time. The issur to eat pig is also all the time. Why is that not called a constant? Only six constant mitzvahs. The prohibition to eat pig is not called a constant because it's not always relevant. It's true you're never allowed to eat pig. But when we say constant, we mean always relevant. Right now, someone wants to eat pig, they're going to have to travel for, I don't know where they're going to find it. So we're not calling it a constant because it's not always relevant. The admonition here is be on guard. You have to realize it's a command here to always be on alert. What am I being exposed to? What am I coming up against? If we appreciate that yes, we live in a world that is constantly on the decline, the rapid deterioration on all kinds of different levels. And if you're not conscious of that, then you get sucked along with it. Just to give, we know that today, within the Orthodox world, there are things that are debated, phenomena, lifestyles that are being debated that just, I'm not that old, but when I was a kid, it was considered, completely on the fringe of the non-Jewish world and wasn't being debated. It was just kind of weird and in the non-Jewish world. And now it's already, the world drops. And let's talk again in a technical sense. We talk about the effects of the advances of technology. Let me just talk in a very simple, mundane sense. What the advances of technology did to people's concentration span. It's mind-boggling. And to realize that, I think I told you, I worked for a publication, a Torah publication company, a prestigious Torah publication company, and they told us at one point, you have to start simplifying the notes more. To start simplifying notes more, and they told us that in the world around, for example, they said named a few of the big famous magazines, they said that the length of the articles went from 4 or 5 pages to like one, a page and a half over, and again, if you are a firm practicing Jew, concentration is a very important thing, right? And here's before we're getting into, people usually talk about, when you talk about the dangers of technology, what you could become exposed to. So before that, assuming that it's all perfectly kosher, around us, the concepts of normal are dropping, dropping, dropping. And if we're not aware, if we're aware of this, we can put up the fences. The idea here is not to bang ourselves over the head. Look how different our generation is from those days. We didn't create that situation. It's not our fault. But on the contrary, it's actually, this is what defines the greatness of our generation. In those days, their greatness was the sterility, the sterile environment that they lived in. In our days, it's if we living in this rapidly deteriorating world can fight that current, can put up the defenses, can fight the current to try to keep it out of our homes and out of our lives as much as we can, to be setting ourselves up with the defensive and to be digging in to resist the slide downward, then you have to appreciate that that is actually where the special greatness of our generation is. That's the special pride that our generation brings Hashem.
So in Egypt, they dropped 49 levels and then Hashem came and took them out. Now, were they grabbing on and trying not to drop? And that's why I said, okay, you're great, you deserve to be taken out. Or did they just fall and he said, oh, I got to save them because they're just going to keep falling?
That's a good question. Just to touch on the question from two different directions. It seems that in Mitzrayim there was a core of people who were doing that, but not the masses.
Are people doing
There was a
what?
core of
Holding
people
on.
who were holding Shevet Levi, but not the masses. But there was a difference between what was going on in Mitzrayim then. What was going on in Mitzrayim was before they got the Torah. They were still in the process before that where they didn't really know what they should be doing. And on the contrary, there was Hashem's promise. This was between Hashem and Avram. I'm going to make your children into my people. And therefore Hashem came and did that. He said, because so to speak, I owe it to Avram. There were certain minimal requirements that he expected of them. He prompted them to do them. That's a big discussion, but it seems to be a little bit of a different dynamic. Here we have the Torah, and we're meant to be holding on to its values in the face of a current that goes against it. And again, the appreciation of the fact that this is actually where we can shine, where we can come up to Shamayim as a generation, look at the generations before us who were so much greater, and be able to tell them, you were so much greater. We looked at you from a distance with reverence, but here is something that we were able to offer Hashem that wasn't relevant for you. And halavad, we should be able to do that behidur, with the vach.